Welcome to Exhuming the Bones, where horror writers talk craft, process, and community. We're tackling a big topic today, horror in general, starting with the question, what is horror? So I thought I would bring in a quote from Fred Botting, who wrote a book called Gothic. He is a professor of English literature and executive member of the London Graduate School at Kingston University, UK. So he has a lot to say about this topic. He offers a definition for horror, saying that it continually exerts its effects in tales of terror. Horror is most often experienced in underground vaults or burial chambers. It freezes human faculties, rendering the mind passive and immobilizing the body. The cause is generally a direct encounter with physical mortality, the touching of a cold corpse, the sight of a decaying body. It arouses the feelings Julia Kristeva associates with abjection.
The whole quote there, that's not like your dictionary quote of horror. No. That was just beautiful in and of itself. So
it's definitely a send up to and an expansion to what most people would classify as a very sophomoric genre. Any time a film or movie is said to be horror, it's automatically like B grade. Something that's like a matinee or on a drive-in. It's not something that's Oscar worthy.
Yeah, I think there's a stigma sometimes that comes with horror, which is unfortunate because it's so multifaceted. It's such a large topic. And I'm going to bring some of the academic language into it today to hopefully tear down some of that stigma, because I think that it deserves to be talked about in multiple ways. We can discuss it with regard to film, and it can be fun. It can be campy. You know, that's, I think, some of my earliest memories of enjoying horror were through film and sharing the jump scare with people and, you know, feeling safe in each other's company.
Speaking of jump scare, I just heard, it was an NPR article. I honestly cannot remember the movie, but a director was on and they were interviewing him for his upcoming film. And apparently one of the things to be a horror movie, like studio executives will set you with a X amount of jump scares per however many minutes. This director had just had it. He was just like, I am so tired of like being nitpicked on every little thing. So he decided to put as many jump scares as he could into this movie and got a Guinness World Record for it.
Oh, that's funny.
So then anytime a new film executive comes to this guy and he's like, oh, you need more jump scares, he can just pull out this Guinness World Record and be like, I think I know my jump scares. I love camp. Like, don't get me wrong. There's some pretty campy movies out there and books. Camp is fun. Camp allows us to make fun of the genre itself. The film Cabin in the Woods was really good at not only showcasing all the fun horror stuff, showcasing like slasher, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the Hellraiser demons, Lovecraft, but it did it in a kind of funny way and turned it on its head. And I think like any time there's a piece of horror that is self-aware and allows it to make fun of the genre in a loving way, then humor and horror is just fun.
What are some of your favorite films?
Oh, there's so many. One of like the big ones for me that got me really scared, I'm talking like I don't want to go back asleep, was Insidious. I think that came out in like 2010, 2011. That scene during the middle of the day when they're having the seance and there's that crazy Darth Maul looking demon behind the guy in like midday, I was white knuckling the seat I was in. It took me a really long time to actually watch The Grudge, but I watched The Grudge and The Grudge 2 and then all the old Hellraiser movies all like back to back. And yeah, The Grudge is pretty legit scary. Went into the whole jump scare thing that was really big during that time, but it was just really atmospheric. And I think that's something that horror touches on as opposed to some other genres, is it's all about atmosphere and feel. Because when you think of horror and you start to describe aspects of horror, you're like, okay, this sounds a lot like other movies I've seen, like, oh, Silence of the Lambs. Hannibal is like one of those big characters of the pantheon of horror characters. But is it actually horror? Because a lot of it is thriller. Almost every police slash detective drama is thriller slash suspense, not so much horror. And you get really, really nitpicky when you start to dissect all the little things about that.
You know, it's so funny. I read a quote just today, and it said that all horror is thriller because of the elements that are in thriller, but not all thrillers are horror. And so we'll talk about subgenres, but you also brought up setting. And I thought it was so interesting that I've not seen Insidious. I love that we get to talk because you always, both of you, you give me ideas for things I need to watch or read. And it sounds totally scary, but you're saying that the setting was this like beautiful day. Right. I mean, that's what I heard you say. And then this thing comes in, this thing that doesn't belong, this scary, horrifying, Grim Reaper-ish, Darth Maul?
Yeah.
Kind of figure. So, but what I'm saying is usually the setting in a horror is creepy in and of itself. Like that's almost one of the benchmarks, although we will talk that horror is, I think, the loosest in terms of following its own recipes, which I would then go back to say it is even more, if you want to say, quote unquote, literary than other genres, because it breaks its own rules with more regularity than I think many of the other genres do. But my point is that you gave this great example of setting, David, and then this thing comes in. So the totality of the setting, even though it was like this kind of day, it was a nice day as opposed to like a dark or rainy night where we often have our settings in horror, the totality with this horrifying thing in there, that is the setting, right? So like almost the one thing I think horror cannot get away from is that the setting itself is delivering those feelings that we're going to talk about more that are kind of the definition, the defining line for horror. So glad you brought that up.
In talking about that, I think you bring up another good thing is about horror breaking itself, because once something starts to become a trope, starts to become something that we see as, oh, they're in a darkened room and the POV just switched to behind something, like the monster shot. That's a really big thing in like slasher and other monster movies. It's like the creature cam. It's like, oh, the creature's going to jump out now. Like we know something's going to happen. So once we start expecting that, it's not scary anymore. Be like, oh, thank God it's daytime in a poltergeist, ghost, demon possession kind of movie, let's say that's going on. Oh, it's daytime. Okay, thank God. That's the time you can like let down your hair and just chill. Nothing scary is gonna, oh my God.
Yeah. Like you remember the end of Friday the 13th, right? When she's sitting in the canoe and it's sunny, right? And everything's been taken care of, right? And you know, and the beautiful music is playing. But we know, even though it's the setting there is supposed to be tranquil, we know something terrible is coming because we have these expectations, right? So
what do y'all think of Jordan Peele?
It's actually really funny. I haven't seen Get Out.
Oh my goodness.
Or Us or Nope. I haven't seen any of them, but to prepare myself to watch them, since Get Out was his directorial debut, I'm like, I want to go back and watch some of the old Key and Peele stuff that was on Comedy Central. And one, the cinematography for Key and Peele is amazing. Like you can see some of the shots they use, like just the framing of the shot and some of the writing and the camera filters they use are total send-ups to like horror. And in one of their sideaways that they have, he instantly says he loves scary movies. So, and you see that like when they're doing a zombie shoot, there's all this like cinematography that's going on. They use like a gray filter to show like the blues and stuff, which you see in post-apocalyptic movies. Or if there's a Western going on, they always use like sepia tones. Holy crap. This was a sketch comedy show. I mean, these are the guys who like cut their teeth on Mad TV, and it was a whole nother level. I'm like, okay, I'm starting to see where they started to really branch out and how they got to Get Out and Us and Nope. He just did a new claymation Coraline kind of thing. Called Wendell and Wild. I think it's on Netflix.
Okay, I haven't heard of that.
Yeah, I haven't seen it myself, but it looks really fun.
Get Out is one of my favorite films, and Us is a close second. I just think that he uses horror as a way to make a commentary on society and racism specifically.
Mm-hmm.
It's just brilliant.
I think that's another thing that horror does really well. Kelly mentioned breaking the norms and the bringing up of Get Out and how it shows a mirror to racial issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting that horror is seen as a sophomoric thing. Comic books are seen as a sophomoric thing too. And comics really try to push the envelope for societal norms or issues or divides. The comic book Black Panther came out like 2 months before the Black Panther group actually came out and named themselves. So, and there's, I'm always brought back to Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, Diary of the Dead, all the George A. Romero zombie films. They're zombie films, 100%, and they're horror. But each and every film, depending on which like decade it came out, is supposed to be a look at that decade's generation and the issues with them.
Can I say something about Out too before we move on to other movies? Because that's the only, when you mentioned that, I guess it's the director's name, I didn't recognize it, but I haven't seen Us or Nope, but Nope is on my list. And now so is Us. Thanks again. But Get Out, I think, is so interesting because it's one of the departures from the usual. There's not a monster per se, right? The monster is us. And that is, I think, kind of new in terms of like what we find scary. The other, what I think genius of Get Out is, besides obviously the cultural nod, like, you know, this is what I have to say about our culture, is the idea that the people we love and trust, you know, in this case, the one of the characters in Get Out, this is the person who should be the one who he can trust and who loves him, turns out to be the villain, turns out to be the one who wants to destroy him. And so honestly, to me personally, I can't think of anything more scary. I mean, you see strangers on the street, and if you think someone could do you harm, that is scary. But to be under a roof with someone who would do you such harm. So I think Get Out really hits so many check boxes for delivering the feelings that, again, the genre horror is known for.
I think that's one of the, like, the key aspects of horror is it allows us to talk about things that are difficult, and it's a little bit more digestible because we're taking this little pill with a spoonful of horrifying sugar.
I like that.
Yeah.
Not to Mary Poppins.
Yeah. That's one of the key, like, aspects I love about horror is anyone can be like, oh, it's just for a scare and it's just supposed to be entertainment. I'm like, it's healing, and it's not just for the writer writing it. I mean, you got to think about why this person is writing this thing. They're going through some sort of turmoil, and this is them getting through that turmoil on the page. So it's healthy for them, but it's also got to be healthy for the audience, and it's got to allow us to grow somehow.
I could take or leave a jump scare. They're okay, but I love the slow burn of fear. Okay, that would be my personal go-to, you know?
Yeah, that's it's poetic, the slow burn.
So I think the slow burn, that actually goes into, well, something I wanted to talk about, which is slashers. I'm not a big fan. I have digested so many slashers, but I'm not a huge fan, mostly because I'm not a huge fan of humans being the monster, mostly because humans are boring. I mean, give me an otherworldly entity that can like rip you from limb to limb just by flicking its wrist. That's cool. Humans are boring, but I know humans are the more cerebral as far as like humans can be monsters too. I mean, there's a reason why people love like the Jeffrey Dahmer stuff and everything, like all the documentaries and shows and whatnot.
You know what? It's that humans, it can be so true, David.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I mean, okay, I'm not going to say maybe a monster could show up at some point, but I think it's more likely that you're going to, you know, find your end or your harm done to you by a human. And that's, I love that you don't find them as scary.
Can I interrupt with a quote real quick? Because this is just perfect for what you were saying. This is from Noel Carroll from his essay, The Nature of Horror. And I love this guy just because of his whole perspective on horror, but also because my maiden name is Carroll. So I don't know, hopefully we're related somewhere in there. But he says, what appears to distinguish the horror story from mere stories with monsters, such as fairy tales, is the attitude of characters in the story to the monsters they chance upon. The humans regard the monsters that they encounter as abnormal, as disturbances of the natural order.
I really like that. My partner and I have been discussing what makes a book X. So like what makes a book horror? What makes a book fantasy? What makes a book sci-fi? For me, for the longest time I kind of saw it as a tipping scale. Does the book have this kind of attitude or air or sense of scene about it? Check. Does it have this kind of character? Check. Does it have zombies in it? And I started to think that it was a scale, like a balancing scale. And the more the scale moved, the more it was in that genre. It wasn't until we started talking about horror as more of a prevailing emotion that I realized my whole idea was wrong.
I love the idea that you said about, you know, if they're checking these boxes, it falls farther and farther into a specific genre. But like Alien is such a great example. It is so sci-fi and it is so horror. And I honestly couldn't say that it's not sci-fi, but I also couldn't say that it's not horror.
There's so many different genres and so many different subgenres of horror, and how horror can intersect in between fantasy and sci-fi and supernatural fiction and even historical fiction and nonfiction and thriller. Because if there's ever a book or a band or whatever, I just look to them. I kind of go with their preferred genre nomenclature.
And if you go on Goodreads for like a genre search, any book, I'm thinking like It or The Stand, I know that I've looked these up, and the genres that come up are fantasy and horror and straight fiction, mystery, suspense, thriller. I'm sure I have not hit all of them. Those are just what I can think of off the top of my head. So yeah, like a lot of what we love is just categorized in so many ways, but I love your idea of, you know, what does the actual author have to say?
I think it's important to remember too, though, that like the creator, the author, the artist can have one intention when they're creating something, but then when it gets out there into the world, it becomes a mirror for other people where they're all seeing pieces of themselves and their experiences and their own culture. And so it's two-sided in that, you know, there was the original intention, but then there's also various ways it can be analyzed. In fact, when you analyze literature, there's a whole school of thought that says the author's dead. We don't want to think about what the author's intent was. What do we see when we look at it on the page? I don't necessarily agree with that, but it is a huge movement.
Yeah, the authors do lose their grip on it, right? An author can say this was my intention, but once it's released out into the world, it becomes what, you know, the culture and the time decides it is collectively, right?
Right.
You have on your notes, David, lots of ideas about the supernatural and ghosts. So I wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Right. I'm under the assumption that certain horrors, even though we say like horror has to break the rules, it's always fun that way. There's like certain cardinal rules that certain subgenres of horror have to adhere to. One of those for me is ghosts and demonic possession and paranormal. A lot of those, especially in movies and books, are that the character has to have some sort of loss of control or control of their surroundings, even if the person themselves is not possessed, which is an inherent loss of control of self. The loss of control over a place that you thought was safe, your home, because there's a poltergeist in your house and stuff is flying everywhere, stuff is moving and you don't really know why. One of the things that always stuck out to me was it always seemed like these specters, whether they be ghosts or demons, even though they're supernatural, they always have to follow some sort of natural laws. We want these supernatural things to behave some sort of natural law, even if it's not ours, it's their natural law. Demons fizz when you throw holy water on them, or they don't like the name of Christ and it causes their ears to bleed. It's still like a law, and that is something that we cling to because we try to understand something that we don't quite understand.
So much of horror is moral, I think. You know what I mean? Like, and a lot of times it can be used, you know, to direct behavior. But I just feel like I have to say, it's so interesting as you're talking, because I grew up in a religious household. I love demonic horror. Like, that's kind of my go-to. I'm sitting here and I'm like, I absolutely hate, it's my one, like, I don't even necessarily need read trigger warnings. But if I know that a movie or a book is going to deal with demonic possession, I can't read it, David. And I think it, because I believe so deeply in that, in like a spiritual realm, and I know we all have our differences in how we necessarily interpret our realities, it scares me so much that I actually can't. And I just, it's so funny because as horror writers, you think, well, you should, you know, on my blog banner, it says the role of the artist is to not look away. And yet, as you're talking, I'm thinking, Kelly, sometimes you look away because that just scares you too much, you know? So I have to point that out.
Yes, I feel so much the same way. And that, well, I shared with you my trauma story from when I was younger about having to watch Possession. But in the film, The Exorcist. But
you pushed it away, Mary. You're like pushing it out of your, right? Seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want anything to do with it.
I don't know. It's like, how real is it for you, right? I mean, there was a movie called The Fourth Kind, and maybe it was because I wasn't expecting it. And
oh, I think
so,
I saw that one.
It's supposedly it's this psychiatrist, and she's taping her. It takes place in Alaska. She's taping her clients, and they're all having a breakdown, and it's all revolving around these visions they're seeing, and there apparently are these aliens. And there's, just like the Blair Witch Trials, there's, you know, the idea of, could this be true? So anyway, it is so, it looks like demon possession, which probably gets me. But the idea is that these aliens are possessing the bodies of these people. So it goes right back to what you were saying about loss of control, right? And then, and Mary, you bring in such a good point, which again, this is a piece of the horror puzzle. A lot of times what scares us is whatever scares children. So like if we're told as writers to write either from the perspective of children or think about what scares children, like, because we're all kind of children. Mary is still, you know, as David's talking, kind of getting the heebie-jeebies, right? Because it throws her back into mm-hmm. when she was a kid and that feeling, and we kind of never lose it. I don't think we do. And so I am actually really interested in what draws us to the different subgenres of horror.
I think Freud would completely agree with you when it comes to the childhood experiences, because so much of his theories have to do with the child and child development and all of that, and kind of how even when we're adults, the roots of our fears are from childhood, and that's where they live, and they reach back to those places and those experiences. He wrote a piece, well, he's written a lot, but he wrote a piece called The Uncanny years ago that actually mentions a lot of that. It has to do with trying to understand what is it that makes us uncomfortable. And he goes into a whole lot of analysis of like words like Heimlich and unheimlich. But what he says that the term uncanny means is that it applies to everything that was intended to remain secret, hidden away, and has come into the open. So if you think about his idea of repression and experiences going back into the unconscious and then resurfacing later in adulthood, or even his conception of the double or the doppelganger. He says this relationship is intensified by the spontaneous transmission of mental processes from one of these persons to the other, what we would call telepathy, so that the one becomes co-owner of the other's knowledge, emotions, and experience. Moreover, a person may identify himself with another and so become unsure of his true self. So it's like whenever there's a double or an echo in a story, I mean, Us, the film Us, is probably one of the most direct representations of the double that I can think of, but you can see it in so many other things with maybe they weren't even intended to be there by the artist or the writer, but when they show up, it gives us a sense of discomfort. Like, well, is this the evil twin? Is this a person who maybe has dissociative identity disorder and it's the same person and they're acting in two different ways and the split is within their own psyche? I'm heavily influenced by psychoanalysis and the psychoanalytic school of thought, both with regard to psychology and the fact that I teach psych, but also in literary analysis and how, when we look through the lens of Freudian theory, so many other things can come to light in a story. I remember analyzing Beloved, Toni Morrison's Beloved, and the double is just present in so many places in that story. And I don't know that Toni Morrison was thinking, I'm going to create doubles throughout the story, but that's exactly what ended up happening. They just manifested. So we ask ourselves the question, was Beloved a ghost? Was Beloved the, you know, actual child that we thought was killed and wasn't killed? Is it some type of echo? Is she being possessed? What is that relationship between Beloved, the child of the main character, and Beloved that shows up in adult form later in the story? So this isn't necessarily connected to Freud, but it's one other thing I wanted to mention based on what y'all were talking about before with ghosts and the supernatural. So I'm less familiar with this, but I just think it's so interesting. So I just want to bring it up and see how you connect with this idea, both of you, or if you do. So I'm in a program, and some of the things I have a lot of familiarity with when it comes to literary analysis and literature in general, mostly American literature. That's kind of my sweet spot. But I was in a class that was, we were analyzing houses, and not the haunted house, but like Howard's End and, you know, the big majestic houses in England, that type of a thing. And he brought up this book called The Spectralities Reader. It's edited by Maria del Pilar Blanco and Esther Perrine, or Piren, from the Bloomsbury Group. And it talks about spectrality in all these different sorts of ways. But the way we were asked in the class to kind of look through this lens is to not think about it like the supernatural and like ghosts, but as history over time in a physical space.
Well, what the first thing that came to mind when you said that was another book entirely not related to horror, but a wonderful book called The Body Keeps the Score, where over the course of your life, the trauma that you endure, that your body actually holds that trauma. And even in your conscious mind may not be aware of it. But here's an example. Rob Lowe, the actor, his mother had a little bit of mental illness, and she often, when she was really low, she walked around in her pajamas. And he mentions in his autobiography that when he sees a woman in pajamas in the daytime, even now, his body has a visceral reaction. Mm-hmm. So going back to what you said, it's like the idea that in time, in homes, in like plantations or different places where a lot of atrocities might happen, or a certain same thing happen over and over, I feel like that could like get into the structure or the ground even, right? Like an area. What is that? That's like the reaction I have to what you just said.
You're so right on, because so, and I know I'm being annoying with quotes. I can't help it.
No,
it's just
we love
my academic brain. So from this book, let me see how this connects with what you just said. Abraham and Torok's notion of the phantom as unconsciously inherited loss or secret is the conceptual metaphor of spectrality, deeply embedded within the discourse of loss, mourning, and recovery that delineated the multidisciplinary project of trauma studies as it emerged in the 1980s. Mm. So you're so right. It absolutely has to do with trauma and fear. And what David was saying before about healing and the potential for healing. And it's saying it's not necessarily a ghost or a phantom, but maybe like the whisper of a person who used to live there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think that's another aspect of paranormal books and movies, is the characters think that they're dealing with a specific spirit or a specific ghost. And it turns out the horribleness and the atrocities that have happened on that piece of land, in that house, have actually culminated and made their own spirit. It's the fact that all the carnage that has happened on this property and all the raw emotion has been left behind to give life to this new thing.
Horror has so many subgenres. So I feel that with horror, kind of my working definition is that it is related to the feelings it elicits. And that's what we keep talking about. We keep talking about our feelings. So the word horror comes from the French word horreur, which means shudder or bristle. So the horror, either whether it's a genre or it's an element of another genre, right? It gives that feeling to a person. So it fills a person with fear or shock or repulsion or thrill. And so sometimes we have a book where there's just an element of horror, and sometimes we have a book where the whole piece would be considered horror. So why do we have that difference? Well, I believe it's because of the vehicle that we choose to deliver the feeling of horror. So if it's the haunted house and that's the vehicle that's delivering it, it's going to be a certain genre. If it's a vampire delivering it, it's a genre. If it's an alien, it's a genre. So we have all these different, and I'm not saying I have the market cornered on the definition, but for me, that kind of helps me to think about horror and how we categorize it. I say, okay, yes, the setting has to have a certain tone, as David was saying, or feel. And yes, a lot of times, Mary, it's so involved in like our psyche, and can we even trust ourselves, and, you know, tapping into like our individual fears. And that's why another thing, and I don't know if we've mentioned it, well, what makes our writing great, if it's going to be great, is that we really have a close POV, because you can have something scary, but if you don't care about the character, it's not going to matter. If you think about, you know, if someone dies who you don't know, it could be very tragic. if your mother, father, child, brother, friend dies, it matters so much more. So our job as a horror writer is to make our characters into our mothers and fathers and brothers, and then have terrible things happen to them. I don't know, wrapping the concept up in my brain was that we have these books that have an element, or we have a book where the main thrust of the conflict is really something horrible. And the whole point of the arc of the plot and the characters is to create those feelings. And so I felt that was a little bit different than other genres that kind of do have more of a checkbox feel than horror. But I wonder what you guys think.
I think conceptually that makes a lot of sense as far as the vehicle of the horror and how does that fit into subgenre. I also have a love-hate relationship with genre conventions because on the one hand, you know, when we're reading a genre or a subgenre, we have expectations as readers. And as writers, we feel the pressure to meet those expectations. At the same time, those can be so culturally defined. And, you know, I'm reading a book right now, Craft in the Real World by Matthew Celestis. And we can have a whole podcast just on this book. And I hope we do at some point.
Awesome.
But he does a really good job of really questioning and being critical of expectations, whether it's genre or just writing and craft in general. Because if we think about it just from the American point of view, mainstream American point of view, we're missing the rest of the world and the fact that in their stories, they have different expectations. And so maybe it comes down to audience. I don't know. I don't want to go into all of that now, but I just feel like
the teaser.
As long as we're talking about genre, I think it's important to mention and just kind of have in the back of our minds what conventions are helpful and what are limiting and possibly harmful.
Absolutely. Well, and also we have to remember it depends where you are in your writing journey. I mean, if you have, you know, you've been writing and publishing and you're not trying to break in, there is more freedom to defy genre conventions. If you're trying to be a debut author and you're trying to get an agent, I love the idea of being creative. And that's just, you know, what do you want out of your writing, you know, career? And I know we speak like our audience of this podcast is hopefully people who they want to be writers or are writers. So that's definitely something I would love to talk further about. I'm voting for that.
There's so much I want to like dissect in what both of you just said. We're missing a whole perspective. That's something that I've really been trying to break down in the last 2 years. Pandemic's really helped actually with my, like the amount of books I've been reading. I try and read stuff from either marginalized groups or people who just aren't from the United States. A lot of it's been horror. I've tried to read a lot of Native American authors recently. One I started, I didn't get a chance to finish it, was called Buffalo is the New Buffalo. The author, she had so many asterisks and footnotes in her pieces to give readers. It really read like a thesis, like an academic thesis. One of the things she said was sci-fi. Almost every aspect of it is done from a colonizer mindset. Either someone is coming to invade us and take our resources, or we're going someplace else and making a home there. And it's never just we meet someone else and coexist with them.
I think you really touched on the key point is the something we don't understand, we're afraid of it, and we kill it.
Yeah.
I often think of just like the smallest example would be if there is a spider crawling toward me, I think it's going to hurt me, right? So if there's a spider crawling toward me, I'm going to smack that. If there's a butterfly inching toward me, I'm going to let it go. And it's the idea that we fear. So this is where this connects, David. We fear what we don't understand, right? And then when we fear something, we want to hurt it.
Yeah, that's one of the fear archetypes is fear of the unknown, fear of the unexplainable. So I think that's right. And it's just what Mary was saying about consuming media, not necessarily from our own.
It's us to know some things we don't know, and then we don't fear. And that's the whole point, I guess. Am I hearing you right?
Because it broadens our understanding of like our world and not only our minds, but other people's minds. I'm going to name drop a few. One is a Afrofuturism/sci-fi by Nahidi Okorofor. She's Nigerian. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure she was born in Ohio, so that's cool. Her sci-fi series is called Binti. The only thing I could describe it as is African Harry Potter. Like, it actually takes place in Africa, in Nigeria, but there's a lot of weird horror elements in there, and that's called Akata Witch. It's just a whole different mindset than what we're used to. There was a book recently that I had heard of called The City Beautiful, which is by Aidan Poledouros. It's a historical fiction horror that takes place in Chicago in 1893 and follows a queer Jewish boy after his friends die, and his friend's spirit, or Dybbuk, possesses him, and he only has X amount of days to figure out who murdered all these other Jewish boys. It was a finalist for a Bram Stoker Award 2021.
I'd love to add a couple to the list as well. So as you were talking, I was thinking Octavia Butler is a wonderful writer. Tanana Reeve-Do, amazing writer, and particularly in horror. And then also there is a book that I don't think it's really recognized enough as horror, but it has supernatural elements. It's called Build Your House Around My Body by Violet Cooper Smith. It's about a Vietnamese American woman, and it's just, she goes to Vietnam, and it's like two different timelines crossing over and experiences with supernatural stuff. It's so good.
That does sound great.
There were a couple of things that you talked about earlier, and I don't even remember who mentioned what. I think this was David talking about how, maybe it was Kelly talking about how there are certain things that we're expected to not write, or there's pressure to include certain things, genre conventions and whatnot. It made me think about Louisa May Alcott. Most people know her as the author of Little Women. She wrote that in 1868. So 1868 is when that came out. But what a lot of people don't know is that she actually wrote Blood and Thunder Tales. She was a horror writer as well. And in the novel Little Women, you have the main character, Jo, being pressured to not write Tales of Blood and Thunder. You know, nobody wants to read that. They want to read about this happy little girl who gets married and everything's good. And that was actually reflecting Louisa May Alcott's experiences. So in studying her, I had to for a course, but also I was really interested. She wrote a lot of Blood and Thunder tales, but one of the best ones is called Behind a Mask. And it is, well, I won't give it all away, but it is shocking in some really strange ways. It's about a nanny who, you know, she looks like this, or is described as this very sweet tutor for children. And then behind closed doors, she like takes out her teeth and takes off her hair. And she's this much older woman, and she's there to swindle the family. And it's a lot of fun. And if you look at the years, so if Louisa May Alcott wrote Little Women in 1868, she wrote Behind a Mask 2 years earlier than that.
You know what that makes me think of? It always comes down to like this, like primal thing, primal fear. Who hasn't had maybe a babysitter or a caregiver who put on one face to the parents, and then the parents leave, and there's an entirely other person taking care of you, and you're kind of at their mercy.
Even.
So that is just a great, I love that you give us and our listeners these options, you know, to go find these books that we might not have heard of otherwise.
So speaking of books we haven't heard of, or I haven't heard of until this semester, actually, David was talking about sci-fi and the fact that it's all connected to colonizer mindset. And I that was so interesting. As you were saying that, I was imagining it differently. And that's absolutely true. There could be an entire class, I think, just based around that idea. But what I found out this semester, of course, we talk about like the origins of Gothic horror being in Europe and castles and things like that. Well, American Gothic, the first book that is recognized, and it's, you know, a lot of people think about Poe as being like the father of horror in America. And certainly, you know, everybody loves Poe. I love Poe. But before him, there was Charles Brockden Brown, who wrote a book called Edgar Huntley, or Memoirs of a Sleepwalker, in 1799.
Oh, nice.
And much of what is in that book is actually about these experiences with Native American tribes. And they're all depicted as vicious and scary. Mm. And it's true that at that time, you know, it was risky being in this country as colonizers, which, you know, we have such a clearer lens on what that did to people looking back in history.
Yeah.
But a lot of the horror that he talks about is not just experiences with people, but the wilderness the unknown, the caves, the darkness. There's a whole scene where he's walking through a cave where he's like, I probably shouldn't be doing this. I can't see where I'm going, but I'm just going to like feel my way along the edge of the cave because I'm so curious. And if I turn back, I might regret it. And, you know, he finds some scary things in there that, you know,
I bet. Maybe-
that's really interesting.
When you hear about American Gothic described, it's more about either the traditional haunted house as we think about it, or caves, the unknown, and nature. So I want to talk about some of the older pieces that really represent a lot of American Gothic and just kind of see what y'all think about them. One of my favorites is Nathaniel Hawthorne, partially because of his connection with the Salem witch trials and his, I think it's his great grandfather being one of the judges in that time in Danvers and Salem. So have y'all read Young Goodman Brown or The House of Seven Gables or anything else by Nathaniel Hawthorne?
I was frantically looking up his name to see what I may have read by him. I don't know. David, have you?
I have not. No, I know of Nathaniel Hawthorne. I have not read those.
So Young Goodman Brown is the story of a man going on a walk at night, and he feels this urgency to go on this trip. And his wife, like, no, please don't go. Please don't go. He goes anyway, and he walks through the woods and he meets a stranger. And of course, it's the devil. Start to realize it's the devil, and he goes walking with the devil in the woods. And, you know, it's a longer story and there's a lot more to it, lots of symbolism and beautiful language. But they get to this clearing where there's people dancing in the woods, like dancing with the devil, and he realizes his wife is there.
Ooh. Ooh. So, because I knew this is my brain problem with me. I've read The Scarlet Letter over and over. I've taught The Scarlet Letter, but I didn't associate it with, I wasn't certain it was Nathaniel Hawthorne. That's where my brain issue goes. So that seems to be, if what you're saying, adultery is like one of the themes he liked to kind of dissect over and over. I mean, I feel like his treatment in The Scarlet Letter of, you know, an adulteress was more like Jesus' treatment, which would be, you know, kind and merciful. But I'm interested now to read. It's Young Goodman Brown is what you've.
Yes. And it's a short story.
Great. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant. The House of Seven Gables is a novel. It is much longer, and it is about a house that was obtained in less than moral ways.
Okay.
Connecting back to the witch trials. You know, we talked about genre conventions before and like how you expect a scary story to progress. This doesn't echo the way that we think about the story today. Mm. It goes off on a whole bunch of tangents and, you know, skips around to different points of view. And it's not the easiest of reads, but it is one of the original haunted house stories. And when we think about like spectrality, how we were talking about it before, like land can inherit a history that's problematic in all sorts of ways. And then we don't even realize, but it's haunting us, even if it's not supernatural.
That's a good way to put it. Haunting us, even if it's not supernatural. You can be haunted without a supernatural presence. That's good.
So Young Goodman Brown came before Edgar Allan Poe wrote The Telltale Heart or The Raven or Cask of Amontillado. And then Hawthorne's House of Seven Gables came out. So just kind of putting them in context with each other, it's interesting that there were these themes going on in American literature.
Good stuff to study. You know, I think it's so interesting. I have come into our group saying I love the classics, and I will say I don't know that I'm as versed as you in horror classics, but there's so much to read when you are an aspiring author. There are these bodies of information, and the classics are absolutely fascinating, and I love the historical aspect, but then you're also expected to really be up on the present day exactly, because if you don't write, you know, if you're not emulating some of the facets of modern writing, then you're also going to be just, you know, you're not going to get seen, right? You're going to be writing and you're going to be putting on your hard drive, and that's where it's going to live, unfortunately.
And, you know, you mentioned before, if you don't follow certain conventions, particularly earlier in your career, you don't necessarily get picked up by literary mags. You don't necessarily get, you know, acceptances from agents. I've heard before, you have too many points of view in this piece when there's only three.
Right. That's what I'm saying. I wonder if other people are like this. It is my dream. You know, I'm trying to break in and I have thoughts about, well, once I'm in, I'm going to write that different book, David, like you were saying. The book that I'm writing now is still the truth of my heart, but I mm-hmm. have other books that I, you know, when I'm more free, will write. And I think many of us are that way.
As creative people, it's hard to be held within the confines of a box. Yet, you know, adhering to some of those confines can help us get better at certain things too. It's that, you know, love-hate relationship, like I was describing before.
What is it? It's the saying. I botch it. You learn the rules.
Before you break them.
Break them like an artist. Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
I think all that's a really good point. I have recently started writing eco-horror poetry, but I remember going back and putting myself in a box and being like, okay, for this poem, I'm strictly going to write an iambic pentameter just to see how difficult it is. And oh my God, was it so difficult? But like the payoff was really fun and it was kind of just like this crazy mental exercise. I guess it's a difference of putting ourselves in a box versus mm-hmm. being forced into it. Mm-hmm. Like if we feel like we're being forced into this box because, oh, you're like Mary, you said, oh, your writing thing has too many points of view. And it's like, but it's only three.
You know, it's like we writers can't imagine that we're different from anybody else. You know, you want to be a master chef, you got to learn to cut carrots. You want to be any kind of supervisor, you need to first learn how to work on the floor. We need to learn our way. I'm okay to follow some of the rules. And I like what you said, though, too, both of you. We push on them as much as we can. Once you have a platform, then you can maybe scream a little louder as opposed to just talking with your voice. I don't know.
No, I think that's right. And I guess it's this weird balance because it's like, oh, well, the rules exist there for a reason. And it's because if you go away from them, it might not be as good. I mean, that's why we use salt instead of sugar when we're sauteing onions. I think you're right. I think sometimes we do need to break outside the realms of the status quo. And again, like you said at the very beginning, that's what horror's great at. Mm. Like we're so used to the scary stuff happening in the graveyard at night. What if it happens during the daytime in someone's kitchen? It's going to be even more terrifying.
That's nice.
Yeah.
When you think about your own work, what is the biggest risk as far as going outside of that expected convention box? What's the biggest risk you've taken?
I wrote a story that was inspired by C.S. Lewis. It was about these, again, we're talking colonizers, but that wasn't in my vocabulary when I read the story. And what amazed me was this alien was looking at humanity with a blank slate. And I am just absolutely intrigued by that. The idea, what would someone say who doesn't jump on the train in our culture? And what are the leaps they would make? And so I wrote a short story kind of exploring that. And that's all I'm going to say right now. But it definitely pushed the edge of what maybe everybody agrees is it's moral. You know, I think horror is a great place to explore moral questions. And I think I've said before, like, I love the idea that a lot of times in horror, people get what they deserve. Like, you know, you think about like the camp story, you know, it's always these kids being bad. And so that's why they get killed. And we're like, well, see, they deserved it. But also good people get killed in horror, but it's definitely a great place to explore the moral question.
How about you, David?
I think my biggest risk as of right now, it's an unfinished project. It is a WIP, a work in progress. I have an issue talking about intimacy, specifically sex. I've always done the whole thing like you see in PG-13 movies of, oh, they go into a room and close the door and the camera's on the other side of the door, the POV's on the other side of the door, but you know what it means. Fades to black and that's all you see. I've tried to explore that a little bit more in the supernatural noir that I'm writing, kind of coming to terms with sexual being in general. Looking back, I wanted it to seem like this guy was a womanizer, like to an extent, kind of unbeknownst to him, like women kind of just like forced themselves on him. But then looking at that, I'm like, wow, that is a really chauvinistic kind of view set. And I really don't like it.
You know what, though? Maybe that because that happens. And that's something that's not talked about in our culture either. Men can be victims too.
I don't know how else to explain it other than that, but it was kind of my way of dealing with it, because it is something hard for like everyone to talk about in polite conversation. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize how bad I had been at it until very recently, and was trying to make a concerted effort for it to not be taboo to talk about, because a lot of things we talk about in horror are also taboo.
I think that's really brave.
You gotta be brave now, Mary. You go.
I feel like the biggest risk I ever took with expectations was writing a piece in second person where it starts out, you know, walk down the street, or you do this or that, because the risk is, what if your reader's like, yeah, no, I wouldn't do that. And they can't connect with your story. So I tried it, and I was pretty happy with the way that it turned out from that perspective. But, you know, it's difficult being somebody who teaches psych in addition to writing and all that, because there are things that I want to write about that have to do with disorder, that have to do with problems of the psyche, in ways that I would never talk about them in class, because I have my teacher hat on, and, you know, we maintain respect for disorders. And I feel that in my heart. At the same time, as a writer, creatively, and from a healing perspective too, like what David was talking about, there are things that I want to write about just from my perspective. And sometimes that can show up as broken, and it can come off sometimes as disrespectful if I'm not careful. Mm. So I feel like that piece was taking a risk in multiple places. First with just expectations and conventions, like writing in second person, but also a subject matter. Mm-hmm. And it did get published. So I guess somebody out there liked it.
That's great.
Yeah. Mine is out there. And so it's, you know,
mine is
ambiguous, which is a safe place to be in as we're talking about taking risks.
You know, I had that sense of ambiguity in mine as well. I mean, there were things that were very clear, but I don't ever come right out and say, hey, this is what's really going on. It's kind of up to the reader to decide. Is that similar?
Yes, exactly. I mean, isn't that what we want? We don't want to tell anybody how to think, right? If we're talking about moral horror or any kind of anything didactic, honestly, I hope I'm using that correctly, because if I want to teach somebody, I want to teach them, I want them to come to their own conclusion. I want to give them some information, and then they choose. I don't want to tell them how this ends and what they should think. So good stuff.
I think that's something, it's a very important motivation to keep at the forefront personally. So yeah, I really respect that. Well, what do you feel like this, because we've barely scratched the surface of horror. We've had a great conversation.
Oh, we could have gone off on tangents.
I know. Yeah. But what do you feel like is the big takeaway for you from this conversation?
I just love the fact that horror is so, I think, versatile. It can do so many things. It can be in so many things. I am a horror writer, but a lot of my larger works have elements of horror, but would not necessarily be classified as straight horror. They're just parts of the story. And I also, I guess the last thing I want to say is that I think that, you know, we often talk about what we're afraid to do, or what our culture, you know, some of the things that are, you know, kind of washing over our culture right now and everyone's kind of consciousness. What I love about fear is that I feel like it's what unites us. So it doesn't matter. Like you were saying, back in the day in the frontier times, you know, Indians, that was a fear. That was a legitimate fear. And so the way he would write about that would be different from how we would write today. But the actual feeling of fear isn't different today than it was then. And so I guess I want to see it that way, that we are united by some of our most, our deepest emotions. That's what makes us human. And I love that about horror.
I feel the same way by a lot of it. The primal fears are what link us all together, not just culturally, but like evolutionarily. There's a reason why we're afraid of the dark. There's a reason why some of us are afraid of spiders or snakes or mirrors or whatever. And it does, it connects us. And it's also really, really therapeutic as not only a writer, but as someone in the audience. Maybe it's the rush of endorphins and serotonin and everything that we're feeling in the seat or why we're reading that book. But if we have a fear of losing control and go in and watch a movie that deals with possession, and at the end of the movie, the evil is expunged, we come out of that with a little bit more of sense of control. I love that Mary brings in the psychological aspects, because it just like rams home these like prevailing ideas I've had about horror for like the past decade plus, like the past two decades of reading and writing and listening and watching horror. And it's just great. It's great to see that like I'm not just crazy and therapy and horror are hand in hand. It's a prevailing thing.
I agree that there's so much potential for healing within the horror genre as a writer, as a reader, as a watcher of film, and just with community, whether we're connecting with the Horror Writers Association or we're connecting with each other, we're connecting with greater society, and its potential for leading us into difficult conversations to talk about things that we need to be talking about, to challenge ourselves, to recognize the value in expected conventions, but also challenge them and see what we can do beyond that. And I also really love bringing in pieces of literature, especially I'm so drawn to American literature, and I'm not really sure why. It's not like it's the only thing that I'm interested in, because I love world literature as well. But I feel like in this country, there's a way to reach back through time by reading. And I love the idea of the writing that I'm doing may someday be that thread someone else is reaching for, whether it's just my daughter and, you know, my line of descendants, or it maybe someday will reach a much wider audience. I love that the power of story can do that. It can make us question, it can make us debate, and it at the end of the day, it's what connects us.
This podcast is a project of the Ohio Chapter of the Horror Writers Association. For more information about the Ohio Chapter, please visit ohiowa.wordpress.com.